Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 155, I chat with industry consultants Ron Williams, Jeff Tully, and Michael Heiss about what they saw and heard at NAB 2013. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 15th, 2013. Episode 155, NAB 2013. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Hulu Plus. Watch as many TV shows as you want, anytime, anywhere, on your devices, all streamed instantly to you. Visit HuluPlus.com/TWiT to start your free two-week trial. That's HuluPlus.com/TWiT, or go to TWiT.tv and click the Hulu Plus banner. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week, we've got a great show lined up here with three guests who went to the NAB show. Unfortunately, I didn't, but they're going to tell us all about it. First, we have Ron Williams, an industry consultant with the Landmark Group. Hey, Ron, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks. You've been a regular on the show here for a few times and always glad to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back.
Now, also we have on the slate today, Jeff Tully, another returning guest, who is also a consultant who spent some time walking around NAB. Hey, Jeff, welcome back.
Good afternoon. It's good to be back, too.
And finally, a newcomer to the show, and one I hope will be back again, Michael Heiss, yet another industry consultant. Seems like the industry has a lot of them. Yeah, right. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
So glad to have all three of you here. Now, those of you who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for any or all of my guests about the NAB show, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, it's a professionals show. It's a show sort of like CES, but instead of for consumers or consumer products, it's for professional products, the people who actually use technology to get content on the air and distributed one way or another. And I suspect, I wasn't there, but I read quite a bit about it, and I suspect that the story, like at CES, was all about 4K. Ron, would you agree with that assessment?
Well, not all about it, but they certainly made a big push in our end of the industry. It's 4K, 4096. The consumer side, it's the Ultra HD, which is 3840 by 2160p.
Right, and we should make that distinction to make sure everybody understands that. We throw around this term 4K sort of in a cavalier manner, but in reality, 4K really should represent what you see in the professional setting and what you will see in the future in the commercial cinemas, which is 4,096 pixels across by 2160 pixels up and down. The home standard for 4K is called UHD or Ultra HD, which has somewhat fewer pixels across, right to left, 3840. By the same number, 2160 up and down. So very often you'll hear 4K being used to refer to either or both of those standards. And you just have to keep in mind that when you're talking about the professional world, you're talking about 4096. When you're talking about the consumer world, you're talking about 3840. So at NAB, I'm sure we saw a lot of 4096. But on the other hand, I bet you they were talking about how to deliver 3840 or UHD to the home. What would you say about that, Jeff? Do you think that was an important part of the show?
There were certainly some pieces of that as well. In fact, not only were they talking about getting the 4K in both flavors produced and delivered to various audiences, there were even some folks showing and talking about 8K and getting it moved around. I won't worry about what the numbers are there as well.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, and showing some of it, actually, NHK showed 8K production transmission from one end of their booth to the other and reception and display. So for those of you who think that the Ultra is a little bit confusing with two sets of numbers, it'll in one sense get more so, but I think in another it won't. We'll see actual products of one kind or another that will actually be in the consumer space, what you see in displays, in theaters, in professional use, but things that you'll see in, like in storefronts and commercial displays like that, as right. well as whatever you may see in home entertainment delivery, whether it's games or movies and that kind of thing. And all of these are going to get labeled in one way or another as something bigger than HD.
Right. Now, Michael Heiss, you took some photos that we have to show, and one of them is the NHK 8K over-the-air transmission, OTA transmission, which I think is what it's called. Yes, NHK 8K OTA.
Yes.
There it is.
And that's the screen of a screen. That's what Jeff was referring to, where they used two terrestrial channels. They got a special permit from the NAB, from the FCC, I'm sorry, to, you know, it's like the old magician used to run a hula hoop to show that there were no wires. And that's pretty much what they were doing, was transmitting from one side to the other. I guess the interesting thing there is that if it took two terrestrial channels to do 8K, you could infer from that you could use one terrestrial channel to do 4K if you had the right encoding, which was maybe another important part of the infrastructure at NAB as it relates to delivery, was this bandwagon for a format called H.265 as opposed to the 264 that's prevalent now, which is going to cut the required bit rate in half so that people can actually transmit this.
Right. The codec, or the compression algorithm, codec stands for coder decoder. You might remember the term modem. Those of us that are old enough might remember the term modem, which stands for modulator demodulator. So codec is a somewhat similar kind of a compression of words, if you will, to compress the video down to a smaller amount of data. And H.264, also known as AVC, I believe, Ron, is that correct?
Yes. 264, yes. The 265 is the HEVC, high efficiency video coding.
And that will...
you'll hear the HEVC, I think, much more than the 265.
Right. I don't know. I personally prefer numbers myself, but maybe that's just because I'm a geek. You know, for example, the Android operating systems, they're all known by dessert names, and the Apple operating systems, too, by cat names. And I get those totally confused, but if I know it's 10.6, 10.7, 10.8, I'm clear on exactly what it means. And the same thing here, you know, H.265, okay, that's newer than H.264. But okay, so HEVC or AVC or whatever it's going to be called. The big important point here is that it takes less storage and it takes less transmission bandwidth to get the content from one place to another.
NHK next year is going to be transmitting the 3840 by 2160 in Japan with their transmission system that we were just talking about. So that's a reality, and that's going to happen. But in my opinion, I think to the consumer, once they see the Ultra HD, when 8K comes along or 16K comes along, they're going to go, yeah, so what? I mean, the human visual system can only absorb so much.
And that's exactly right.
The sharper the picture and the more that's there, all that's well and good. But the reality for NAB with going into the 4K, the 4096 and the 8K, and there are several companies showing 8K post-production tools, there's a really unique tool, shall I say, that the broadcasters now have at their hands.
if you take a 4K picture, and I think Scott, one of the past shows we touched on this, is that you can shoot something in that wide format. And, you know, you have a picture that's yay big, but you can take this 1920 by 1080 and you can do a pan and scan and find what you want out of that frame and just use that.
As a 1080 image, you mean?
Right. Right.
In fact, 1920 Scott, by 1080. There's actually a clip a picture showing how one of the vendors, Miranda, which is now owned by Belden, the Wire folks, was demonstrating that at NAB.
Oh, you know what? Let me see. I don't think I sent that one over to John. I'm so sorry. Of course, that would be the one we would want to look at. Sure. Yeah, they were looking at, I do remember that photo, and it was a picture of a 4K panel that had been split up into four 1920 by 1080 images, right?
Right. Or yeah, but as Ron said, or if you picture the masters and you wanted to zoom in on something, you would be able to take advantage of the 4K original image and electronically zoom in to a close up and still have it be full HD 1080.
It's funny you mentioned the masters. Tiger Woods lost out. He got fourth place or something. And even that was after a shot that the golf ball hit the pole at the hole and then bounced away and into a water trap or something. And had you had that zoom in, you could have seen that ball just go click against that. That's pretty good.
CBS did use 4K on the Super Bowl. They did just exactly that.
They could zoom in.
Yeah, they had four 4K cameras CBS had there. They were the 4A, the high-speed 4K cameras, and they used them on a Super Bowl to do just exactly what Mike was suggesting. And that works very well. So what I'm saying, my point here is to the broadcasters into the production group, yeah, go ahead, go to these big high rates. That's fine. Because it gives you more tools and a better way of shooting as a production value. But as far as in the home, I'm going to be old school. I'm going to stick on in 5 or 6 years, you may get 4K.
Well, and the other side of that is it's not only the encoding that has to come along, but a means of distribution. There was some talk of that at NAB, but the last part of that, which was really behind the scenes, is you don't have the chips yet. So if someone were to build some sort of 4K decoder, the chips from the likes of a Broadcom or whomever, those are still, they say, a year away from sample and probably 2 years away from production. So the products in the marketplace would have to follow that schedule.
And then there's and we're going to talk about 4K distribution here in a minute. But there is also the issue, which Undermined in the chat room is pointing out, that 4K sets, UHD TVs, of which we've now heard the announcement of several, are limited to 24 frames per second or at most 30 frames per second, not 60 as the current video standard is. Jeff, what did you hear about anything in regards to an upgraded HDMI spec or anything along those lines?
I didn't hear it at NAB specifically talking about the HDMI spec, but that is what leads to the limit that you were just reading. It's not that you can't get it into the TVs in some fashion. It's just that the current HDMI spec 1.4 has in the spec limit 30 frames per second at the Ultra HD data size. And in practice, it's a little hard to get that. 24:25 is actually what's really being seen in the devices. That's with a single HDMI wire. There are folks out there, though, that are using Red, for example, showed a Red Ray player and going to the displays, and they're able to use four HDMI feeds out from their set into some decoder boxes that will handle the speed. And there you get the full resolution, Ultra HD, the 4K. But it is correct to say that, you know, when we get to the ultimately what's going to be in the home, the HDMI 2.0, 2.1, that is in process right now, will need to be built into these chips.
And that's a hard, that's a hardware issue. So what Michael was saying about, you know, the Broadcom chips or whatever being a year or two out, we might very well have the same situation with HDMI, right, Michael?
Yeah, and in fact, not only for HDMI, some of the folks that I spoke to at the show were also saying that behind the scenes there's work going on at Intel for Thunderbolt, which Apple is a big proponent on, and DVI, which is still very important. DVI, a DisplayPort.
DisplayPort,
yeah. The behind the scenes in both of those areas as well, not only to accommodate the 4K60, but also 10-bit and 12-bit color, which are equally important if you want the ultimate image.
Exactly right. Sorry, Ron, go ahead.
We have a little another little twist to this whole thing. Is the ATSC is now putting together 2.5. Which 3. Is backwards 0. Compatible in 3.0, which is not backwards compatible. But
now wait. Tell us what you're talking about here. ATSC 2.5 or 3.0? What do you mean by that?
At the American Television Standards Committee, the folks who write the standards for what is broadcast over the air,
right?
For the government, has I'd say they're about 80% finished with 2.5, which is a really unique, nice broadcast standard, which encompasses all of the second screen things in your mobile. So they've incorporated all of the little handheld devices, et cetera, that are floating around your house and in your hands into the broadcast so that the broadcasters can now push things right directly to your phone. You don't have to worry about the mobile telecom people
now,
being
this is,
your provider.
This is the over-the-air signal, right?
Right. Now that
How do they propose to do that? You've got a you've got an antenna, presumably on your roof or maybe in your attic or maybe on top of the TV, rabbit ears, whatever.
Right.
How are they going to get that signal that's coming to that antenna and then going into your receiver and your TV to also be on your mobile phone or your tablet?
Right now, the present hardware would have a little adapter that plugs in either into the earpiece and or to the little power plug. So everybody's going to play nice and everything's going to be happy. But in another 4 years, when 3.0 comes out, it's not going to be backwards compatible. But, in fact, it will be far more robust and handle the 4K and maybe up to 8K. So that straw man is on the table now for 3.0. But 2.5 is just very close to being ratified by the government.
Mm.
So by the time that gets pushed out, saying what Mike did about the chipsets and things like that, it should all fall in the proper timing if all goes well.
The ATSC folks seem to be pretty hell-bent on 2015 for the finalization of the standard, but then you really have to add another year or two before the chips and everything are in place, and then, God forbid, you've got to get the FCC involved. Here's another great acronym for you, Scott, the FOBTV, the Future of Broadcast Television. And that's really where they're trying to get FOBTV. It's probably a new network. They're trying to get all of these guys together to agree to a global standard, which they came close with HDTV, but you still have DVB outside of the U.S. and ATSC in the U.S. And a few other places. So there's still no global agreement.
Well, plus the fact that in Europe, anyway, it's 50 frames per second, and in the U.S., it's 60 frames per second. Were they talking about making a standard there, too, or were they just going to let that be different?
I haven't heard of that, but I'm sure that that's something they're trying to do. Remember, TV sets haven't been driven by line frequency for years. It's all electronically generated now.
Right.
So the 50-60 thing isn't as critical as it was in years gone by.
Right.
Well, the 50-60 thing, as Mike pointed out, is just ridiculous as to having 59.9 instead of 60 frame and 23.98 instead of 24 frames.
Right.
It's just ridiculous. We've been fighting that in the standards committees for a very long time, but there are this old holdouts that want to have it for some particular reason. But yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out.
You don't love your drop frames?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you can get around that really easy, the time of day versus the frames. But nonetheless, your point about the 50-60 is just really pretty ridiculous because there isn't anything that really actually runs on the line rate anymore.
We just want to give a little historical perspective here. The reason that video is at 60 frames per second historically in this country and at 50 frames per second in Europe is because the AC power line in the United States ran at 60 hertz, 60 cycles per second. And in Europe, it's 50 cycles per second. And the TV was synchronized using that frequency coming off the power line that it had to be plugged into. But nowadays, as Michael pointed out, it's all electronically done. It's completely divorced from the line frequency. It could be anything we want. So
it's all
that's
run
just
on DC anyways.
Yeah, right. Beatmaster in the chat room is saying, talking about codecs and 4K, what about Sony suing Red? Did anybody hear anything? Jeff, did you hear anything about this? I just learned about this the other day, that Sony was suing Red over certain patents, and Red has sued Sony in the past, and there's all this litigation going on. What's up with that?
Yeah, I heard, in passing a news story on it, but nothing in detail.
Nothing in detail at the show.
If you really want to know.
Yeah.
If you really want to know. About 9 years ago, Red went and did what most people can do. You can go file for a patent for anything. And
yeah,
this
right.
patent pretty much falls into the category of they went down and patented oxygen. But that's what it falls in the category of. Their patent, as it is with a typical encode, the normal encoding that everyone uses, if you're at 24 frames higher than 4K, they have a patent on it. So if you do anything higher than 24 frames in an encoded 444 at 4K, pay me money. So that was kind of ridiculous, and it went on and on and on. And in, this is my opinion now, is that Red went after Sony, even though all camera manufacturers do this. They went after Sony specifically because of the F65 movie camera, the first one at 4K, 4096. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, okay, that's fine. Went to the first court. Court says it's a good patent, not a problem. Sony fought, went to the second court. Court says, it's a pretty good patent. We're going to have to do something. So Sony said, well, we're going to litigate it. So the court went to Red and said, well, what is it that you actually want for restitution? They said, well, we don't want any money. What we want is for Sony to recall all the F-65s that ever sold and give them to us so we can crush them.
Oh, my wow. God.
That's the lawsuit. As it stands right now, well, now we know that's never going to happen.
No, of course not.
That's Red posturing themselves and, flying in their arms in the air and making all kinds of noise. But that's pretty much what the legal situation is, as was at NAB.
And
everyone agrees that it's just totally ridiculous. But
ridiculous.
This isn't the first time Red's gone and pushed a patent like this. And oddly to say, Sony's done the same thing to other manufacturers through the years. So it's nothing to either one of them. But in this case, it's pretty ludicrous that
they could say
anything like that to happen.
Yeah.
But the court did agree, the second court did agree that that patent really should have never been granted.
It seems that way to me. It seems only normal.
Well, now, remember, about 10 years ago, there's a company in Burbank, actually, that they patented 24-frame video.
Survive legal challenges?
Yeah, it did. And up until October of 2012, all the camera manufacturers that were doing 24-frame were paying the patent fee.
Wow. What happened in October?
The patent ran out.
Ah. Wow. Well, speaking of Red, Jeff, I know you went to the Red booth and were looking around. In particular, I'm very interested to hear what they had to say, if anything, on their Red Ray 4K media server, which is a little box that can serve. We were talking about it earlier, having up to four HDMI outputs. That thing's been on pre-order for a while. Are we ever going to see it?
they were certainly saying that they're going to start shipping it fairly soon. They,
in fact, we have a photo of a stack of Red Ray boxes. I don't remember the exact name of it, but if it's I'm pretty sure we can see a stack of Red Ray boxes that a picture that Mike took. There it is. So they're in production.
And they said they were the pre-order price was $14.50, and they told me it's at NAB that it's now $17.49.
Whoa! Okay.
So they went up a little bit. Jeff, what did you learn about this box, if anything?
Well, they were showing it operational. They had, in fact, a content service that's got a little bit of information about it on the internet called. Not exactly sure how to pronounce it. Odemax, O-D-E-M-A-X.
Odemax.
Yeah, and it's a content service that if you are an owner of a Red Box, you can sign and subscribe to the movie service and essentially download 4K movies that have been loaded into this service by independent film producers, anybody who owns content that they want to have distributed. Odemax is kind of being a, maybe YouTube on steroids is one way to say it. You know, it's all 4K content. They but built a back end.
Go ahead.
Now, I was going to say they built a back end that is tied very much to the Red camera and the production workflows to make it as easy as possible to take a film that's shot on Red and edited and produced in 4K and then encode it. Encrypt it, package it, and put it into this Odemax service for distribution.
And is that a download service that the file would get downloaded and put on a hard disk or some sort of memory system on the Red Ray box, or is it streaming?
No, definitely not streaming. And they were quick to point this out as they showed it, that don't expect this to stream. It'll take quite a while, even with a good fast internet service, to load the movie to a hard drive. But it has a pretty good sized hard drive in it. It'll hold a good number of movies inside it. And then they were showing these playing in several different parts of their booth, actually. They had one area where they showed the Odemax GUI and how to access it. How a second login is for an independent film producer who can have an account. And they then can go in and build their own page that's seen by the consumer, put whatever films they have, establish whatever pricing models they wish to have and load their content into the system that way. And then there is a third aspect to this that is targeted towards small theater venues. And what Red and Odemax together say is they will have a Red laser projector for use in small venue theaters that will have a built-in Red Ray player in it. The theater owner can log into this Odemax service and subscribe to have a schedule of a particular film played in Theater One on Monday and Wednesdays at 2:00, that kind of scheduling. Mm-hmm. And they handle the bookkeeping, if you will, back and forth between, again, those independent film owners who have put movies up there and either consumers or theaters that are playing that content out. So they showed in that sense, a fairly complete ecosystem from the camera all the way to the living room. And around the corner from that, they then showed the Red boxes that hooked up to that service had loaded their movies in, and they had a Sony, Toshiba, and Samsung 4K displays, ones that are currently announced from all of those manufacturers, and they were showing it hooked up and playing the content.
Now, this Odemax service will accept content from anybody or only those who have shot with Red cameras?
They didn't seem to really make a difference one way or the other. I think they'd obviously have a tighter alignment with people that shot on Red, but they seem to be saying that they were talking to all the studios about the content. And it's worth noting, actually, that Jeff mentioned the projector, and that was one of the things I was a little disappointed that last year, I believe you saw the Red Ray was shown at NAB, and at CES they told us come to NAB, and at NAB they said it's kind of still in the back room.
We do have a picture, actually, that I took last year at last year's NAB of the red camera, or projector, rather, laser projector, and red ray. And just to show you a picture of it, here it was in their reinforced glass case. This was NAB 2012. And the cool thing about it, this projector that I really want to happen, and it hasn't yet, is that it's laser illuminated, and the laser illumination is in a separate module. One of the boxes that you see in that photo, I think the larger of the three, largest of the three, holds a red, green, and blue laser, and that those laser beams are fed to the projector through fiber optics. And you can gang them together. You could daisy chain several of them together depending on how big a screen you need to fill, which I thought was a brilliant idea. Not only that, last year at NAB 2012, they told us that the projector with one laser module was going to be $10,000, which is less than half the price of the Sony 4K projector at $25,000.
It was so, really invisible this year. I'm so sorry to hear that.
somebody told me, was it Mike, was it you or Jeff, that that they said, well, they have to keep it in the back room. They're doing some tweaks. They don't want to bring it out before it's time.
That's all I could get out of them.
same answer.
Yeah.
But Christy did in fact show the their laser projector.
Right, which we have a picture of as well. The Christy 4D4K 2560. Right. There it is. Which is a laser projector. And I have to say, I want to tell you guys all, if I hadn't mentioned it already, that I did go and see G.I. Joe at AMC Burbank 16. Their ETX theater had the Christy laser projector in there for a couple of weeks. And I went and saw it. And, you know, it was the first time that anybody had shown a laser projector in a commercial setting like that. And they were claiming 3D brightness of 14 foot Lamberts. Which is very high. Typically, when you go to see a 3D movie, the amount of light hitting your eye through the glasses is more like 3, 4, 5 foot Lamberts. So I didn't notice it being tremendously brighter. But then again, I usually go to projector 3D projection screenings that use two projectors. So if one projector with lasers can match two projectors in an with using conventional lamps, then that's a pretty good deal. Anybody see any laser projector demonstrations at the show?
I didn't see any. Yeah, the Christie, which they said from another number, is 72,000 lumens.
Oh, man.
To get the 14-foot Lamberts on a 65-foot screen.
Mm-hmm.
At the Digital Cinema Summit, they ran the material. But the odd thing was that they, for us geeks, they put up test patterns, and they put up color bars in the standard 422 video path, and then they put up the high-resolution video for the laser projector, and that red bar just jumped right out at you. But then when they ran the trailers, it was disappointing. It was quite disappointing.
Hmm.
We all agreed that we'd have thought that the colorimetry of that laser projector with the trailers would have jumped out at you, but it really didn't. It was just kind of less than normal, I would say. So I was not impressed with it at all.
You know, one of the criticisms I had about going to see G.I. Joe with a laser projector was that the colors didn't look right. And they had claimed that they had recolor timed the file for the laser projector. But the flesh tones look kind of orangey. It just didn't look that good.
That's pretty much what we saw when they ran the trailers at the Digital Cinema Summit, is that when they put test patterns up, they knocked your socks off. But when they ran the trailers, it was disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's plenty more to talk about, a lot more, in fact, that we're going to get to. But before we do, I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Hulu Plus. Now, Hulu Plus, as you may or may not know, offers unlimited instant streaming of current hit TV shows, classic series, and much more. It's more aimed at TV rather than movies, but they do have plenty of movies on there as well. But it's a fast and easy way to watch your favorite shows. And it's available on just about any device you care to mention. Certainly, there's a Hulu Plus app on most TVs and Blu-ray players, gaming boxes, set-top boxes like Roku and so on, even mobile phones and tablets. We're talking about Second Screen earlier, and certainly Hulu Plus works with those second screens very much as well. You can even continue your viewing experience seamlessly across devices, start on one, finish on another, and it gives you access to current season hit shows. This is very important because most other streaming services will give you older content, but not the current content. Now, for one low monthly subscription fee, which is what I prefer rather than paying piecemeal, you can get current hit shows from Comedy Central, Fox, NBC, ABC, and others. Now, for example, they carry The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, two of my favorite shows. Law & Order, which is an older show, but I still like watching it. Firefly, again, an older show, but certainly I'd never get tired of that one. Twilight Zone is very old, of course, but who doesn't like The Twilight Zone? There are so many TV shows and things that you can see there that you'll never run out of content. I know I haven't yet, that's for sure. Now, there's an offer for TWIT listeners that I want to make sure you understand. You can get an extra free week when you try Hulu Plus today. Visit HuluPlus.com/TWIT. Get a free 2-week trial instead of one. Or you can go to twit.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, HuluPlus.com/TWIT. And we thank Hulu Plus very much for their support of the TWIT network and of Home Theater Geeks. So we were talking about the Red Ray server, 4K server, and the Odamax system that will deliver content to that server. Sony also has a server, which is a little bit different. And I want you guys to help us all understand how it's different. First of all, it's less than half the cost of the Red Ray, which is kind of interesting. $700, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. The hat box.
The hat box. We have a picture, I think, of the hat box. Did I send that up there? Yes, I did. It's a very cool kind of looking thing. It's not your typical rectangular black box in the home theater. It looks like a hat box. And they announced this at CES. And now I guess it's closer to reality. Jeff, what did you learn about it?
Actually, I didn't see that one at NAB. I had seen it at CES and talked to a few folks about it, but didn't see anything in...
You didn't see any news there. How about you, Mike?
Yeah, actually, what they had initially announced was the one that they were giving to people that bought the large 83-inch or 85-inch, I can't remember which one, set. You buy the set for $25,000, you get the server for free. This will be available for $700 to people who buy the newer, less expensive sets, and it will come with prepackaged movies and the ones Karate Bridge on the River Kwai, Karate Kid. I'd love to see Bridge on the River Kwai in 4K. That should be interesting.
Should
and
be
a bunch
good,
of
yeah.
other movies. But
actually,
it's
we have a picture. We have a picture of the movies, 4K titles. That should give us an idea. These are the original 10 movies, I believe, that came on that.
Yeah, those are the ones that you'll get with the box.
And then they will deliver other movies, other 4K titles, again, by a downloading paradigm, right?
Right, by that forward and store context that one of the other folks spoke about, that it's just too difficult right now to do the real-time streaming. So it's going to be forward and store for quite a while.
Right. Ron, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the Sony player is limited only to Sony products. Is that correct?
From what I understand from the product managers at CES, and a little bit oddly enough, the guys at NAB weren't that well versed with it. Hugo Garzioni, who was the vice president of technology, he went through it with me. At CES and then at NAB, I thought there would be something other than that. But no, they still limit the link to their set. There's a handshake that goes between the two. So
which
it is limiting.
Terribly limiting. Boy, I just got to tell you, I'm really concerned about that. SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room is saying, you know, the 4K media for Sony only works with Sony 4K TVs. And his understanding is it doesn't even work with their 4K projector. And I'm going,
No, it doesn't.
You might think that one of the things they're waiting for is the HDMI 2.0 or whatever they call it, the next HDMI standard to really gel and be available before they open that up, because the same questions are being asked about 4K server capability for the forthcoming PS4. Will it be able to do the same thing? Nobody knows.
Right, right. And the other limitation that I imagine Sony will put on that is that you'll only get titles from Sony Pictures. Now, they've got plenty. They got a nice catalog, but they're not the only game in town.
I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. I mean, as they've done so far, as you saw in your picture, they're all Sony titles, Sony conversions. But they have quite a library, and I think they're going to want to stick with that because it's in-house and it's cheap to do. But if they opened it up to other venues to bring in more titles, then that opens it up, and then you've got some competition again against your Hulu and HBO Go, and it goes on and on and on. And you don't want to open up that can of worms.
Well, and there's the studio politics. You remember the ties between Disney and Apple. So I think the likelihood of ever seeing Disney titles on that Sony hotbox in the foreseeable future is kind of slim.
Yes, kind of slim. Now, Sony also introduced before NAB, but I think they showed them there. In fact, we have a picture of it of two smaller 4K TVs. And this brings up, and Michael, you mentioned that the hat box will be available for these smaller TVs for $700, which is, you know, in the scheme of things, not that bad. The and these are 55 and 65 inches. These two TVs
at $49.99 and $69.99,
right? Which is a lot for 55 and 65 inch TVs, but after all, they're 4K or UHD to be more specific. Jeff, what's your feeling about the fact that the smaller TVs at 4K aren't really going to show you much of anything unless you sit with your nose almost right up to them?
Well, that's one of the things, even with the very large sets that you hear people talking about, is the fact that the viewing distance to see the difference of this ultra definition is that you have to sit fairly close to it, even the 12-foot screens. Closer than a lot of people think most living room viewing would be done at, which is one reason that, in addition to the resolution, another aspect of what's been talked about of the value of UHD is down the road going to be possibly higher frame rates and increased color space, you know, a different, broader color space than Rec 709.
A greater bit depth, as I think Ron or Michael mentioned before, you know, 10 or 12 bit color as well.
Right. And, you know, higher dynamic range is one of the aspects that Ed Dolby and a number of others have been touting as well. And some of those characteristics, the color and dynamic range, are in a sense more visible to a consumer more immediately than necessarily the higher resolution, depending on how far away you are from the set.
And even I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Michael.
Even by take it to another level, I went to the NHK 8K demo where they had a 300-inch screen showing 8K images, and I didn't get there in time to sit in the front row. And the video was really stunning, no question about it. But it wasn't the same as when you're there. You don't get the same benefit as when your nose is right up in the picture.
Right, exactly right. I had a question and now it escaped me. I'll come back to it when I think of it. It was, well, let me just go look at my notes. When all else fails, look at your notes. We saw 8K. High frame rate. That's what it was. Somebody mentioned high frame rate. And I wondered if any of you If there was any more demonstration of high frame rate, we saw The Hobbit this year, of course, at 48 frames per second in each eye, shot at 48 frames on the red camera. And it got kind of a mixed reaction. And I wonder what NAB had to say about high frame rate this year. I don't know who might have seen something, but somebody jump in there.
Again, in that same NHK area, they had 8K at 120 hertz, but they really weren't showing it on an 8K display. They were down converting it to 4K, and you could definitely see that it was better, but there aren't any displays yet for it. So it's sort of a tree in the forest, and nobody can see it fall.
Ron, did you get any sense of high frame rate at the show?
No, the only high frame rate that was being shown that I saw was at Christie, and it was more or less kind of a rehash of last year's Jim Cameron high frame rate presentation. But other than that, high frame rate wasn't, other than the NHK booth, it wasn't mentioned much of anywhere.
I'm kind of surprised at that, actually, because that was such a big deal. And Avatar 2 is coming out presumably at 48 or 60 frames per second. So, and as you say, Mike, NHK was out at 120 frames per second. That should have looked amazing in terms of the clarity of motion. Did you notice anything about that?
It did. They were showing a scroll that was running behind in front of a model, and it was all video. It was live pictures there, and that was one big honker camera. I would say you won't find little point of view cameras in that. You could definitely tell the difference, but again, it's just, there's no practical broad distribution application for it yet because the rest of the infrastructure and the displays aren't there yet.
Right. Well, this is really the problem, isn't it? I mean, 8K is somewhere down the line. Japan, NHK, is working on it. But really what we have to expect more immediately, but not necessarily immediately, is 4K.
Do the math. 7680 by 4320 by 10 or 12 bit color by 120 frames. Dem's a lot of bits.
That's a big file.
That is a big file. And we're having trouble figuring out how we're going to deal with 4K files at this point, how we're going to distribute them, how we're going to deal with them. Now, Miranda had there was a slide from Miranda that Michael took a picture of, which is the path of 4K and, in fact, combining HD or 1080p with 4K in the production and then in the presentation. And we can see it here. That they're already working on that. I assume there were plenty of companies there working on the 4K production and post-production pathway to get the content from one place to another, from the conception and creation to the distribution ultimately. Any news there?
That was pretty much all over the place. In that hall where that shot was taken, there were two or three other companies showing this kind of thing. But again, it's as you mentioned and as Jeff or Ron mentioned, it was also for doing multi-viewers or for medical or geophysical kind of things where people want to have – or command and control applications where people want one big screen and a lot of high-def images. And in the early stages, that's where I think you'll see as much 4K as you will in the general consumer world.
Hmm. Undermined in the chat room asks, any news on a 4K Blu-ray or disc format? Anybody hear anything about that?
Nope. There was talk at CES about going to a five-layer Blu-ray, but the Blu-ray people, I don't know, maybe Jeff, you're pretty knowledgeable about those guys. They're seem to be a little behind the eight ball a bit.
Yeah, they're supposedly having discussions about what it will take to create the capability of carrying the data. We talked a little bit earlier about the HEVC codec, and it seems that with that, the expectation is that you'll get a good level of compression so that you could theoretically fit a movie on even an existing dual-layer Blu-ray disc, possibly. Mm-hmm. Fitting it on as a Blu-ray ROM, you could do now. You could take the Red format movie or the Sony format, save it as a data file, and simply use the Blu-ray ROM disc as a way of transporting that file to your local server. But in terms of building up, you know, a player that's going to play it back from the disc, that's going to require some fairly hefty surgery on the Blu-ray spec itself in file structure, in codec, and a number of other elements. And they are supposedly having conversations along those lines, but they're certainly not out in front as far as 4K. I think you're going to see the Sony and Red approach of a progressive download, you know, into a server, probably mm-hmm. being more prominent. The Red guys even pointed out, and I'm sure the Sony one would work the same way, you could also take a high capacity USB stick. I mean, what you use to carry the bits from one point to another is not really terribly significant. It's the DRM that gives you access to open up and decrypt and play the file and mm-hmm. the codec decoder itself in the box.
Right. And in fact, Sony, when it first announced this server that it was going to ship along with its 4K display, was going to had the plan to deliver new 4K content to users of that system with a Blu-ray ROM data disk, and then just, you know, pop it into with a drive and it would load into the hard drive and then you'd be able to play it. And then there are a lot of people online talking about, well, there's this format called BDXL, which is a four-layer system that has a capacity of 100 gigabytes or possibly 128 in some cases. And wouldn't that be enough? And I keep pointing out that, well, yeah, but Blu-ray BDXL is a read-write format. There isn't a ROM format for it yet.
I think the answer is going to come as much as they can through compression. There really isn't a lot of desire to throw out the existing universe of players and go to something else if they can avoid it.
Ron, did you have something to add to that?
No, I agree with Mike. I'm it's a problem. It's a problem.
It's a problem.
Well, it'll come out when the new HDMI chips come out.
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly.
Well, DisplayPort.
Yeah.
Well, or Thunderbolt.
You didn't mention in the CD market has been touting a bit to the HD Base T.
Good
another
point.
Interface protocol.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
I saw it. Epson has one of their regular projectors that's got the HD Base T built into the projector. They were showing that over in their booth.
Interesting, because that HD Base T carries HDMI, Ethernet, even a little bit of power, all on one cable. It eliminates a bunch of cables, and it's a pretty good idea. But this brings up a point that, Ron, you and I have talked about in the past, and I'd love to get the other guys hit on it, is can DisplayPort or HD Base T or Thunderbolt, for that matter, ever really replace HDMI in the consumer marketplace? Because HDMI is so entrenched.
Scott, HD Base T really works hand-in-hand with HDMI. So when the HDMI 2.0 comes out, HD Base T presumably will adapt so that you could send the HDMI 2.0 signal over the HD Base T link.
But it uses a different connector, does it not?
Well, it's a category cable. So it's just a means of sending that over a category cable or sending those multiple signals over one Cat 5 or Cat 6, preferably, cable than over an HDMI cable, and doing away with the distance limitation, which is why somebody like Epson is very well advised to build it into a projector. That's where I think you really see a lot of use of HD Base T for those long links between your equipment rack and a projector up in the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Ron, did you have something to add there?
Well, I from the committee HDMI committee at CES, the meeting I went to, you know, I'm going to be looking way out there before 2.0 comes. It's going to be a long ways. And DisplayPort's here. It's now. It works. But to your point, getting the CE manufacturers to adopt DisplayPort is the monumental task. Basically, my analogy to that is HDMI is like Apple's or Windows, and DisplayPort is Linux. Mm. Nobody owns it. Nobody's pushing it. Nobody's there pouring money into marketing. It's a great system. It's robust. It can handle anything. But there's nobody to push it. Just like Linux, there's nobody to push it. It's a great OS. Unfortunately, I think we're going to be stuck. But it's the stumbling blocks that the HDMI committee has with 2.0 are just horrendous. And I don't think it's going to be a long time.
And that's why it's delayed. And this was, if this is your call, Scott, they were going to announce this at CES, and then they pulled that back. And now they're talking maybe June.
which really means we might see something at CEDIA or maybe not in September.
Well, it's standard. But then remember, how long is it going to be before there's silicon available? Because I think everybody agrees that to accommodate the extra bits that are going to be a key part of this, they're going to have to go to new silicon. So they're...
Yes.
You're talking, wait for the samples of the chips, wait for the manufacturers to get the samples, build the products. So you're talking 18 to 24 months.
Yeah. As Ron said, another couple of years at least down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. DisplayPort's here and works now, but oh well.
Oh well.
Oh well.
Nerve in the chat room is... Sorry, go ahead.
I think I'm one of the few people in the world that have my notebooks are all Linux, so... What's that say?
Ah, well, there you go. Nerve in the chat room is saying, the industry should probably embrace BitTorrent for distribution or some sort of P2P. Is there any talk of this? It's probably taboo. Anybody hear anything about doing some sort of BitTorrent type distribution? Probably not.
Nope, I haven't.
When that's brought up, they say, we don't want to be Napstered.
Right. Right. Exactly. Did anybody hear anything? We've been talking about video all this time, but before we go, I just want to know if anybody heard anything at the show about 3D audio systems. We know about Dolby Atmos, of course, which is speakers all around you and speakers overhead. It's an object-oriented audio system where the mixer can sort of steer objects around the hemispherical space. We have Barco Oro in the home. Those are both theatrical formats. We also have in the home DTS Neo X and some other high numbers of channels. Did anybody hear anything about anything like that at NAB, or was it all video?
No, the DTS people actually, if you love Format Wars, there's another one brewing.
Oh, and, good. I can't wait.
Gives us all something to write about.
Yeah, well, there's that.
Dolby has Atmos, and whenever Dolby has something, DTS has to have something. And theirs is called MDA, I believe. And it's a similar type of thing where you're mapping out objects in 3D space. And both Dolby and DTS are trying to, in different ways, promote their offering as a standard. I think DTS is a little bit more willing, apparently, to open theirs up. And there were Fairlight is bonding up with DTS, I believe, for workplace tools. So yes. there's a lot of action behind the scenes, but you've got another one.
Yet another form.
Another one.
Oh, man.
Yeah, there. Just so you'll know, too, in the NHK, I don't know if we mentioned the branding they've put on this so that you'll know, not have to worry about 8K, except for you, Scott. You're the number guy, but the rest of us will be calling this new thing Super High Vision if NHK has their way.
Oh, that's what it's going to be called, SHV. Huh?
Yep, and a piece of their demonstration on kind of the opposite side from where the photo was taken, where you saw the transmission workflow. They did have production and playback of their augmented audio system. They had a 22.2 multi-channel audio that has basically three layers of speakers, ceiling mounted, about nine of them, a series of speakers around the room at listener height, if you would, and then a row of subwoofers across the front at a lower level.
Oh, man. Did you hear this? Did you hear this?
I think they said it was running in the 8K theater.
Yes, they did run it in the theater. I did hear it. And it was pretty interesting. They were running tones around so you could hear them here, here, and down there. And then the interesting thing is the Korean Research Labs had a 22.2 soundbar in a little demo room.
What?
It was pretty interesting. It was 32 drivers, 16 below the screen and 16 above the screen. So it was actually an above and below soundbar, heavily dependent on reflected sound, but yet the demo room had no hard ceiling. But it was interesting. I mean, it wasn't the same kind of 22.2 that you had in the NHK theater, but it was reasonably effective.
Mm-hmm. One more thing, Ron, I know that you looked at a lot of cameras, and one of the interesting things that happened at NAB that I read about was the dropping of the cost of cameras. And we have a picture of the Blackmagic camera, or several of the Blackmagic cameras that were on display there. But tell us a bit about how 4K cameras and even the lowly HD cameras are now becoming, and even the production equipment are now becoming available and accessible to those of us who are not full professionals with giant budgets.
The camera thing this year was pretty unique. Blackmagic, they hadn't shown that 4K camera last year, and it's in movie standard terms, it's not quite there. I mean, we still have producers and directors doing B shots with LSRs from Canon. Canon's got their C300 for that purpose, and they just showed the C500, their 4K camera. The Canon booth was like the biggest footprint in the show. They just went all out with all of their lenses and their new equipment. They also showed a quite unique camera. They called it 4K delivery. We don't quite understand where that name came from the marketing people. But it's a C500 type cinema camera that's set up for high-end photography, shooting models, magazine covers, and things like that. They just shoot rather than the flash, 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 click, 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 and all the chatter that everybody's used to. He just roams around and tells the model what to do. Then they go back and they have their own piece of software where they go in and grab the frame, which would have been the still that he took. But the selection that the ad agencies have is huge because they're running at, 24 frames a second. So they can actually pick it out, goes into their software, and do the image manipulation all in one package from Canon for the ad agencies and for printed press. And the word there is they sell on those things like popcorn. So I was kind of impressed with that. The JVC, they had their 3840 camera now as a reality. It's a little palm core camera. Mm-hmm. And let's see.
The Blackmagic 4K, I think, is under $4,000.
Yes. Yeah.
A dollar a pixel.
You kind of get what you pay for, Scott.
Okay. All right. But then you can get some editing equipment, and I think you told me that was in the $2,500 range.
Yeah. There's they have stuff that's $2,500. They have a broadcast switcher pass through for broadcast at $5,000. So you could literally do television broadcast for about $5,000, outside of the cameras, which was pretty unique. Mm-hmm. Let's see, cameras. Grass Valley, Philips, the Philips group in Breda came up with a brand new CMOS chip that was quite unique. They have their little magic that they put into it. And it's a CMOS chip that is basically noise-free, which is pretty remarkable.
Wow.
And it also has a global shutter in the chip so that when you see fan blades or a helicopter, the blades moving aren't bent. They're absolutely straight all the way across.
Wow. And, well, you know what? You know what? I hate to cut you off. We're unfortunately a little over time here, and there's so much more to talk about. I want to have each of you back at another time to get a little more detailed and in-depth about all the stuff we saw there and you saw there. I didn't get there. Next year I'm going, by the way. Because there's just too much good stuff to miss, and I was sorry to miss it this year. But I'm so glad all three of you went and were able to come and share what you saw and heard and experienced there at NAB. Once again, thank you to Ron Williams, Jeff Tully, and Michael Heiss, all three of you industry consultants and well-versed in all of this. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can get to Ron Williams at his website, landmarkcolor.com. Michael Heiss writes for Residential Systems at residentialsystems.com and hiddenwires.com. Jeff, is there a website we want to tell people to go find you or not at this point?
Jeffrey@tully.com. We'll give the...
there's the email anyway.
Email address.
Anybody wants to write you, then that's the way to do it. Yeah. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com and hometheaterhifi.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks at twit.tv/htg or on its new YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week's guest geek is going to remain a surprise. I had a last-minute dropout, so I need to fill that spot. So tune in next week to find out what interesting geeky stuff we talk about, because it certainly will be that. As to who it is, tune in to find out. Until then, geek out.